Okay, it's Fabio Akira again from the Ruby on Rails podcast Brazil, and another non-Ruby topic that's very, very interesting. It's about Erlang. I just interviewed Ian Leonard, and now I have Francesco Cesarini that was giving a cool tutorial on Erlang. And so let's try to understand more about this awesome language that is not new, and it's solving a lot of new problems for us in the scalable world. So please, Francesco, can you give us a background of where you work and what you've been doing with Erlang all this time?
Hi, thank you for having me. Well, I've been working with Erlang now for about 15 years. Initially at the computer science lab with the inventors of Erlang, moved on to Ericsson's training consulting arm, and soon after Erlang was released as open source, founded Erlang Training Consulting, which is today the largest kind of one-stop shop for Erlang out there.
So it's based in London?
We're based in London, but we've got offices in Poland, in Sweden, and soon also in the States, in California.
Yeah, I understand I'm a newbie in Erlang, but I understand it was created in Ericsson to solve telecommunications problems. So what was the motivation and how did it came to be?
Ericsson had just become world leaders with the AXE10, so the first digital switch. And they were looking at programming languages to develop the next generation of packet-based switches. And the computer science lab spent about 2 years exploring all of the languages which were available at the time. So we're looking at Occam, they looked at Smalltalk, Prolog, ML, C, and many others, and quickly came to the conclusion that there were a lot of languages which had desirable features, but there was no one language which encompassed them all. So they decided to go in and actually invent their own language. In effect, that's what happened. Uh-huh. They're doing the very kind of Swedish thing of recycling ideas from...
It's Swedish.
Yeah. Erlang originates from Sweden. Ericsson's a Swedish company.
Okay.
So we've had headquarters in Sweden. So what they did is they decided to recycle all the best ideas from the languages they'd studied for 2 years. And in doing so, they spent another 4 or 5 years just prototyping telecom applications based on a virtual machine. And they prototyped the plain old telephony system. They had side projects with users trying to, rewrite some of the existing functionality in some of the switches which were there. And after, all these years spent with a virtual machine written in Prolog, they moved on, wrote the first C virtual machine, and about a year later, so as to get speed, and about a year later, they started the first project. But once again, on a very small scale, 4 or 5 users, the first system had maybe 15,000 lines of Erlang code. And this brings us all the way to 1994, when this product was released. Feedback came back to the language, and only then did they actually go out and launch it on a large scale and started using it for major projects. So they started small, learned from their mistakes, built on them, and ended up with a language which, is today used for telecom applications. But what are telecom applications? They're distributed, massively concurrent, soft real-time systems which require requirements on high availability.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes banking, that includes web applications, yeah. E-commerce, computer telephony,
anything
traceability.
Anything
server-side, Erlang's a perfect match.
And how did you came about with Erlang? How? What was the first approach? Why did you came up with how you learn Erlang?
Okay.
It's cool.
What happened was they were teaching Erlang at Uppsala University. It was the very first time it was ever taught in a university. And as part of the computer science program there, you get to study for at least 15 different languages. So it was one of the many which we went in and dabbled, and it was fun, it was cool, impressed that for every process you didn't have an OS thread. And I didn't think that much about it until about 6 months later, we were given the exact same lab, the exact same exercises with AFL.
Okay.
And we had to implement it in an object, it was a simulation of... carrot patches going around, and then the rabbits went down and ate the carrots, and if the rabbits got fat they split up, and then you had wolves running around trying to eat the rabbits.
Okay.
And the goal was to create a balanced world, an ecosystem, and resolving the exact same problem with AFL six months later.
Just so people can understand.
Eiffel is a language by Bertrand Meyer, an object-oriented language. Yeah,
exactly.
By solving the exact same problem, it ended up taking about 50% longer, even though I'd already solved the problem once and had all of the algorithms and had already, knew exactly how to solve it and what architecture to use. And that actually made me stop and think it was something more to Erlang than just a cool and up-and-coming language. And as a result, I contacted Joe Armstrong, the inventor of Erlang, and had an interview and a few days later. And before I know it, I was doing my master thesis with him.
Okay, so you used Erlang ever since.
I've used Erlang full time.
You never used any other thing as other than Erlang?
From my side, yes, but it's always the right tool for the right job.
Okay.
So if we need, we'll do the high level design. We'll use Erlang, but if we need number crunching applications, we'll use C to do the number crunching. If we need a lot of GUI front ends, we'll probably go down the Java route. But from my side personally, yes, it's mainly been Erlang.
Just to understand the genealogy of Erlang, would you say that it's derived or inspired by other functional programming languages such as OCaml or...
Not OCaml. Well, it's inspired by ML and Lisp, definitely.
Okay.
And then
without the parentheses.
Exactly. Exactly. And then other features, Smalltalk. Smalltalk, I think, was one of the first language which had software upgrade during runtime.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I believe Occam as well with the concurrency model. These are all of the
inspirations
which resulted, were the best feature. And Prolog as well. Pattern matching was, for example, taken from Prolog.
That's true.
And today in Erlang itself, it will actually is one of the keys to reducing your code size drastically.
Mm-hmm. You would say, could I say that the main features of Erlang is the heavy pattern matching usage, the functional programming style, the hot swapping, and the high concurrency of light processes. Those are the main features?
You've got the concurrency, which is lightweight processes, incredibly powerful and incredibly lightweight. It will take microseconds to create new processes and microseconds for message passing. Another feature is the fact that there is no shared memory and no pointers, and very few, no destructive operations except for the ETS tables. And the fact that if two processes need to share data, the only way is to copy it from one process to another and have two copies of it. This makes Erlang perfect for multi-core.
I can understand, lightweight processes are native threads or green threads or something like that share memory?
No, so lightweight processes are processes which exist within one specific thread. So you've got the virtual machine will run in one OS thread,
mm-hmm.
more if you're using multi-core, so you'll have one per core. And these lightweight processes, see Erlang as an operating system
mm-hmm.
where it handles all of the scheduling of these processes. So all of these lightweight processes are themselves running on one single thread.
Okay, and more than that, it makes it easy for you to have multiple servers or boxes and communicate between each other. It's transparent for me as an application
developer. That is where the distribution comes in. Because if you've got several boxes, Erlang has built in a distribution. So when you're sending a message to a different process, it's the same syntax and semantics. If the process identifier you're sending the message to is on a separate node or on a separate machine, it will actually send it and forward it on without the developer having to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do things right, and from the beginning, you can very easily move your program, written to run on a single node on many machines and distribute it across the cluster.
Okay, and what kinds of applications have you been working on over all those years? Mainly telecom applications, or what other kinds?
We've been working with, initially it was mainly telecoms, and I think we've reached there of the early majority. But if you look, we've also been working with banking systems, we've been working with traceability systems, web applications. We've been working with a whole range of distributed soft real-time systems, computer telephony.
Can you list some clients that are using your lang, or just something that is not discussed?
Some won't discuss it. Others are very open about it. I'll kind of stick to clients which have presented at conferences, so it's no secret. But
Ericsson has
major projects using Erlang, but Ericsson's competitors are trailing along. So Motorola is using Erlang. Not only they went in and sponsored a very interesting study where Erlang was compared to C++.
Okay. Oh yeah. That's
at Harriet Watt University, showing that if you use Erlang for the right tasks, you can get up to 20 times less code and faster execution times than C++.
Okay.
Other cases, other applications which were migrated had maybe 10 times less, 4 to 10 times less code, and were slower. So it just depends on the application, obviously. But it was for the first time there that you had scientific evidence of these claims which have been hanging around the community. Yahoo,
okay.
Delicious. There's a large part of the Delicious backend is written in Erlang. They presented at the Commercial Users of Functional Programming in Victoria recently. Amazon SimpleDB is written in Erlang.
Oh, cool! I didn't know that. Oh, I forgot about SimpleDB. Yeah. Yes, of course.
You've got Nortel's SSL accelerators. So another competitor of Ericsson is using Erlang. So if you hand in your tax returns here in the U.S., it will go for Deltian's SSL accelerators.
Okay.
And little Erlang processes will be running.
Okay. And you being a teacher, I think you're the right guy for me to ask this question. So most of the mainstream programmers, especially those that do web development, they're used to imperative languages derived from C, like Java, C Sharp, and stuff like that. And most of them are not aware that there is this branch called functional programming.
Yeah.
How would you define functional programming from the point of view of someone that comes from imperative languages?
When you're trying to explain functional programming to someone, we're an imperative background, there are a few hurdles they need to cross in order to understand Erlang. Obviously, you don't call them hurdles when you're teaching.
Of course.
You just explain it, else you'll get a mental block. But the first hurdle is pattern matching.
Mm-hmm.
And that usually goes fairly quick. And pattern matching is used for three things. One is for variable assignment.
Mm-hmm.
The second is to pick the flow of execution. And the third is to extract values from composite data types. The second hurdle is the recursive definition of lists. Lists are, think of, the key data structure in functional programming and in Erlang as well, and you do a lot of recursion on lists. So there's a special formula or definition developers need to understand, and once they've understood that, the last hurdle is actually recursion itself and understanding the difference between tail recursion and non-tail recursion. Erlang has something called last call optimization, which means that if you recurse in a function which is tail recursive, so the last thing you do is call the function itself, the function will evaluate in a constant space.
Exactly.
A constant memory space.
And this is important because for us, when we think about recursion, we think about stack, and when we think about stack, we think about overflowing the stack and recursion going out of control.
Getting out of control. And with last call optimization, your stack space remains constant. You don't create
an infinity recursion without ever exploding the memory.
That is the only way to keep processes alive, continuing recursing in a loop in the same function. So,
it's interesting that you have a lot of this kind of recursion. So when you use it to control the flow of the application of a function calling itself again and going on, and I think this is a pattern of the functional programming style. And
that is correct. Yes.
And another thing that many people don't understand is the high-order function stuff.
High-order functions, these were added in the language in 1995, so they came later, influenced by people in the whole functional programming community, more specifically Phil Wadler. And I'm actually writing, funny enough, that chapter right now for the book I'm putting together.
Okay.
And they were almost high order functions were snuck into Erlang. Product management.
It was not in the beginning.
No, it was not in the beginning. And the inventors of Erlang went to the Erlang product management and asked, can we add high order functions and list comprehensions in the language? And they got, no, not right now. It's not a priority. So they went, okay, fine. And they went in and added them anyhow, but not documenting them.
Oh, by the way, the list comprehensions was not in the beginning as
no,
well.
No, list comprehensions was not in the beginning either, no.
Oh, by the way, this is one thing that for Ruby is a kind of different because Python has list comprehensions. Can you explain easily?
List comprehensions is based on the set theory. And the whole idea is that you create sets where represented by lists through generators which generate other lists and filters which will filter the elements generated by the generators.
It's a way to get a set and filter it down to another set. Something like simplifying the explanation would be something like this.
That is correct, yes. So you generate sets and then you filter them. And so it's a very compact way of generating other lists. And an example is you can, for example, implement pivot sort with about 3 or 4 lines of Erlang code using list comprehensions. That's how powerful it is.
Got it. And I think the other great, now the most talked feature is about non-shared state, which is what allows for the concurrency to happen without you having race conditions. And
exactly. Without having shared memory, that makes the concurrent programming really, really easy. So the only thing a developer needs to think of is his own process and just the sequential flow. When it's done, he terminates the process and that's it. So that actually reduces the size of the programs drastically.
Yeah. One thing that you explained during the tutorial that was very interesting, and it's different from the imperative language. Whenever you set a variable, it's not actually a variable because you can't reassign it.
You've got single assignment, yes. Exactly. So calling it a variable might be wrong, but
it's not a variable.
That's right. But it's a bit like, you know, if you write, you know, in maths and calculus, they teach you that A is equal to A plus 1. Well, no, A can't be equal to A plus 1.
Yes.
Because A already has a value, and if you add 1 to it,
it's
not A anymore. And they've applied that to Erlang itself. So that you've got single assignment of variables, which means that once you've bound the variable, you cannot change it.
Mm-hmm.
This forces programmers to write short, concise functions and actually reduces the error rate in the code, which was exactly what the inventors had in mind.
It will not be a normal thing for you to find method functions with 2,000 lines inside of it. It would be very difficult unless you're a very bad programmer.
That is correct. That is correct.
And it's another cool thing because you touch about math, because many computer science students nowadays, they are so into the market and I want to learn Java and they're bored about all the math. And the math is important because without the math, you can't come up with things like functional programming.
It is a very worrying trend. One of the things I do is actually also teach in universities, and I go in and I teach Erlang, which is then used as part of a distributed programming course. And at least in Europe, Western Europe, it's the trend is there's less and less mathematics which is being taught, and mathematics is the base of computer science. And maybe not that you might need the maths itself, but it trains the brain to reason in a specific way.
What branches, what courses of math do you think are the most important for students to pay attention to?
Discrete mathematics and calculus, 1 and 2, variable calculus.
Because I remember, it's a thing that I like because in the genealogy of languages, you have Fortran way back, but you have Lisp also way back, began with Lambda calculus.
Exactly. Even though you don't need to know Lambda calculus to understand something, it certainly helps. And the same comes to logic and understanding logic.
Mm-hmm.
I think the 4 years I spent with my degree, I think at least 1 year was solid mathematics.
Yeah, I think Google brought it up to the table because the only way for you to do those massive searches on Google is using functional notions of map and reduce.
Exactly, and yes.
It became a word now that people repeat without understanding what map reduce is all about. Can you give us an overview about this concept of map reduce?
Well, it's basically the ability to distribute your computations across a cluster of machines and then group the results together.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's actually a, and it's fun that you actually bring up MapReduce, there's a project called the DISCO project.
DISCO?
The DISCO project, yes, implemented by Nokia Research, yet another competitor of, of Ericsson, written in Erlang, which does exactly this. It uses Erlang for MapReduce. You've got Python on the top, and then it uses Erlang to distribute the computations across a cluster of machines.
Okay, and that one thing that I read way back, I think it was 2003, I don't know if you're aware of Joel Spolsky.
Yes.
He wrote an article called The Pearls of Java Schools, and where he says exactly that. It's impossible for someone to come up with Google without knowing functional programming, because in the functional programming field, notions like map and reduce are ingrained to the culture of this kind of programming.
Exactly.
So you would feel that this kind of concept is not alien to you. It's a very obvious thing.
It is, yes. I mean, I agree. And it's, but, and you know, going back to what I was saying earlier, it's obvious when you take on new people on board who don't have the same background, you need to go back to the drawing board and re-explain it. So it's, and then, yeah, but it will vary, obviously, from country to country.
When you teach... another question. When you teach about Erlang universities, Erlang functional programming, I think, you do explain both, or it's a generic course?
No, you don't explain functional programming. You go in and you explain Erlang. It's a bit like the first example on recursion. You don't tell them it's recursion, it's just there.
Oh, okay.
And they all understand it. And then all of a sudden you use the R word and you know, people freeze.
But you see people getting... defensive about learning this kind of thing?
Absolutely not, no. At least the group I have every year at the IT University in Gothenburg are really open and they love it. You go in and you point out how it actually affects their day-to-day life. You ask them how many called your grandmothers last week and you know, half the class will raise their hand. Well, you know, went through an Erlang-based system, your call was routed with Erlang. How many of you, you know, came to the UK and received a welcome SMS? And another... you will raise a hand, well, you know, that was powered by Erlang. And, you know, language they maybe had never heard of before the course, they realize that it's being used so extensively that they're really, really positive about it.
Yes.
So, yeah, and even though, you know, Erlang might be 20 years old, it doesn't feel like it. It was way ahead of its time when it first came out.
Another thing is that I think it began a new trend is beginning right now, and I think it started with the Pragmatic Programmer's book from Joe Armstrong. Mm-hmm. I think it's the only book right now, current book about Erlang, and I know that you're writing a book right now. So what are the subjects that are you touching this book?
Okay, I'm writing Erlang Programming together with Professor Simon Thompson at the University of Kent. And we're covering the basics of Erlang right now. We're looking at a complement to Joe Armstrong's book, where we look at much less than what Joe covers, but much more in depth, aiming exactly at universities and at people who might struggle understanding recursion, who might not understand pattern matching, and that's where we put a lot of effort.
Oh, I see. In theories, not only on the language syntax or stuff like that.
Exactly. So we go in and understand how do you actually need to reason in order to tackle recursion. What is the importance of pattern matching and why, you know, why is it there? Why was it added to the language? So these are the things, these are the areas we cover.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we looked at, just looking at concurrency, I mean, we probably spent have a total of about 50 pages just covering the concurrency model.
Well, I see. So, what's the name of the book and when is it coming out?
The name of the book is Erlang Programming. It's going to be published by O'Reilly and hopefully come out in April next year.
Okay. Coming back to the technical stuff, there is another thing about Erlang called OTP that you can see in many websites, and can you describe it and why it's important and what is it?
certainly. OTP, Erlang is just a programming language. You know, in order to build distributed, massively concurrent software client systems, which never go down, you need much more than a programming language. You need middleware. And that is what OTP is. It's a middleware which contains a lot of reusable components. So Mnesia, for example, which is a distributed relational database. It's got systems for release handling, so how to build your own releases. It's got debugging and tracing tools. And it's got a lot of other components you can just take and plug in, an SNMP agent, a Corba Orb. I could go on and on, but it's, you know, Erlang might not have changed that much in 20 years. OTP has and is changing, and they're adding new components all the time. So that's one end, actually. I'd like to add, yeah. Then there's a second part of OTP, which is design principles. Mm. How do you structure a system? How do you actually get 100 engineers on a project, possibly remotely spread across several countries, if not continents, to actually use the same design, use the same principles, and together create something which, you know, can be integrated without any major issues. Mm-hmm. This is what OTP actually solves, which I think also reflects a way in which Ericsson used to work.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, one of the powers, and I think that's another, say, Erlang is maybe 33% of the power, OTP is 33% of the power. And the last one, which you did not mention, however, is the virtual machine.
Oh, okay.
Which is constantly undergoing changes, and it's constantly being optimized and improved.
Mm.
So, then that is where I think all the R&D from Ericsson is going into, and what really is, you know, one of the things which makes Erlang really powerful, which, you know, is what enables this lightweight concurrency, what enables, you know, running Erlang on multi-core.
Okay, and you also mentioned that it was way ahead of its time, and nowadays it's given that you have garbage collector, that you have all those stuff, but Erlang already had that way back when it was created.
It had a garbage collector, yes, 20 years ago. Going back and getting nostalgic, but back in 95, people called us crazy when we said that we were implementing soft real-time systems in an interpreted language.
Oh, by the way, it's good for real-time application as well?
Absolutely. You usually get a response in the order of milliseconds.
Oh, I see. Because one of the problems in the Java world that people are always talking about is because of the, you have automatic garbage collector, so it's unpredictable, it can stop the world, so real-time can be difficult. How is that in Erlang?
Well, the beauty of Erlang is that you don't have shared memory, and that's what causes problems with the Java garbage collector. Without shared memory, it's much easier to garbage collect. And it's a generational garbage collector which is triggered only when the process needs more memory. So as a result, it's very, very efficient and lightweight. And, you know, of course, it will have impact on performance, but the impact will be a fraction of what you will see in other programming languages.
Awesome. And what are the other open source projects built in Erlang that you use or you can recommend using?
Okay, I mean, I think the major one right now is eJabberD. So it's, I think, one of the biggest, one of the most used XMPP servers. CouchDB is really gaining traction and will soon be used in major commercial products. Another one, well, the Disco project, which we came across and have already mentioned. The Erlang Web, which is a framework for building web-based applications.
Okay.
I wouldn't call it a replacement to Ruby on Rails, absolutely not, but there are times where you want to, for example, build an operation and maintenance node in Erlang, and it's easier just to have one technology instead of having spreading several technologies, and that's where that would come in.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly scalable.
Got it.
Yeah. And, you know, there are new projects coming out every day. It's very, very hard, you know, to sit here and list them all.
Of course.
I don't want to make anyone angry by forgetting many others, but it's there are new projects, which we're discovering almost on a weekly basis.
Okay, and do you having worked in Erlang for 15 years, do you feel that right now we are having a burst of the of people coming into the community, the interest in Erlang growing? What do you attribute that for?
The growth is exponential right now. If you look at, for example, the statistics on the hits of Erlang.org, it's going up exponentially. It's almost doubling in size every year. And just recently, I think we hit the 2 million mark. 2 million hits on the website.
Awesome.
You know, comparing it to the 20,000 we had 10 years ago when Erlang was first released as open source. what it is attributed to? Well, there is no one specific reason. I think we're reaching the critical mass. So people speak to each other, and these people then speak to others. Mm-hmm. So you know, that is, I think, one of the reasons. Another is bloggers. It started with blogging. I think Erlang started getting a lot of attention and PR with, I say, Yariv Saddam, which was the first major blogger here in Silicon Valley, who started blogging about it and was getting hundreds of thousands of hits on his blog. Another reason is Joe Armstrong's book, mm-hmm. Programming Erlang, which is the first English book in over 10 years, which was published. That has helped push Erlang forward. Another is new trends in functional programming. A lot of people saying that functional programming will be the next object-oriented trend, and mm-hmm. That's so Erlang is jumping on that wave as well. And I'd say finally multicore, and the fact that Erlang scales almost linearly on multicore.
Awesome.
And solves, you know, major problems which other languages with, for example, shared memories have.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think my theory is that it functional programming became it's not a new thing because it's been around for decades now, but it's interesting because we were all assuming that the CPU would just go up all the time. We would jump from 2 gigahertz to 3 gigahertz and whatnot. And all of a sudden, we have multi-core, like you mentioned, and now we have this problem that we don't know how to solve. But functional programming knows how to solve it from decades now.
It was an accident
yeah.
that it's able to solve it. But Erlang just happened to be at the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look, the very first experiments they did with Erlang on multi-core was back in 1996 at the computer science lab where Pekka Hedvig did a master thesis project on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they ran everything on a machine with four processors on a quad-core machine and had really, really impressive results. The only problems they were having back then was on I/O. The problem was that it was, at the time, much cheaper to buy four machines
uh-huh.
than to buy a machine with four processors. And so it never really picked up until 2006 when with R11B, they released the first release of multicore, Erlang multicore.
Yeah, now every single notebook in the planet has dual core at least.
Exactly. And just to give you an example where, you know, multicore is completely hidden from the developers. So when Ericsson ported its first product to multicore, it took them 2 weeks to port. And in doing so, they changed operating system on that system. They changed the hardware and processor architecture. And in 2 weeks, they had the system up and running. And in doing so, they didn't even go in and recompile the Erlang code.
Awesome.
And you know, they got a 1.7 speed up just by not doing anything. It took a bit longer to bring into production and start selling. Reason is race conditions, and all of a sudden new race conditions which weren't showing up previously showed up. But other than that, you know, that's how easy it is.
Mm-hmm. And I think every university that dropped functional programming teaching will now regret it, and every student that dropped functional programming will regret it, because back then computer science was supposed to learn the basics of programming, not only one language. So they had Scheme and Lisp, but now they don't.
Computer science degrees are supposed to teach people how to learn new programming languages.
Exactly.
The language is not to learn Java or C++. because by the time they graduate, a lot of the technologies they might have learned are already obsolete. If they're not able to hang along with the times, mm-hmm. they'll never make it onto the next step. And you know, when the languages they're using become out of date, what's going to happen then?
Awesome, yeah. And I hope this new trend becomes a wake-up call for everybody that's using technology to go and learn the foundations, learn what has been there for the last 50 years, I think, using Lisp and Scheme, whatever. Do you have any remarks for students and whatnot?
Well, I mean, just to recapitulate, you know, what I've said, and it's, you know, a strong base of mathematics and a strong basis of languages, where different where you study different concepts of the different languages, okay, and understand them, and that will in turn allow you to move on and understand new languages as they're invented.
Okay, I think this is it. Do you have any last remarks, or do you want to comment on anything else?
No, but thank you so much for having me.
Okay, thank you. So this was the Rails Podcast Brazil again, and I'll see you later. Bye bye.